Now, I want to pick up where I left off last time. We finished out the few entries on Lithuanian lore. And as I explained, Eitan, you want to turn on the lights, please? And as I explained in relation to these divisions, they're very superficial. So there's no question we'll come back to Lithuania many, many more times. But in dividing it up, what I put in the Lithuanian lore were those entries or those insights which don't bear upon Brisk, per se, or Reb Chaim, or Reb Meisher. Obviously, we'll come back to Lithuania. And then we started Chassidus. And, of course, we spoke in terms, when we talk in terms of Chassidus, we spoke in terms of Reb Baruch Yaakov Reisberg, who, of course, was the Rav's Rebbe. And this was a Rebbe that had a tremendous influence on the Rav's gestalt. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. I just want to make clear again that when Jack says to me, "Ah, this is beautiful, this is magnificent, the people would love this," when, for instance, my analysis of the Pot Rabin of last week, it is an amazing thought with the Rav and Cheder, a Soloveitchik, a Briska, a Rebbe who's a Chabadnik, Pot Rabin. With my analysis of my study mate Yitzchak, but just remember, that's all my analysis. While I'm willing to stand on the fact that I'm 99% right, I don't think anyone can challenge me, anyone who knew the Rav well and understood the nuances of his voice and tone, but nevertheless, be aware, it's my analysis. I want to stress that, because the volume, word by word, this is the Rav according to the Rav. My analysis is my analysis, and that's the difference, and that's why I want to keep the two areas clear. The tapes represent Aaron Rakefer analyzing the Rav. The book represents the Rav telling about his own life or analyzing himself, and there's a very important difference between the two, obviously. Now, I want to come into the heart of Chassidus today, and I want to say that here the Rav was raised in Brisk, was raised in Volozhin, was raised in Pruzhana. And there's no question, when you talk in terms of the Rav, you're talking about the Litvish heritage, the Litvish being. Nevertheless, due to factors beyond his control, his father becoming the Rav of Chaslovich, moving to Chaslovich, Chabad, Warsaw, Majid, Sker, there is no doubt that this being exposed to Hasidus during his formative years had a great influence on the Rav. You didn't see it in the classroom where it was Kula Brisk and Kula Volozhin, but you certainly saw it in his drashot and his philosophical stance and in the emotion that he sought to convey. Now, what comes across in the world of Hasidus as the Rav saw it, I find a number of themes that are constant. One theme is this simple individual. And we'll come into that today, and you come into it time and again. Simply meaning, in the world of Litta, the world of a legend, the world of Brisk, who are the heroes? Who carries the day? Gedolei Yisrael, the Talmidei Chachamim. Learning is a premium. The simple individual is trampled by those that have the great minds and the great ability and the chiddush and the insight. We don't have many tales of simpletons in Volozhin Yeshiva or simpletons sitting before Reb Chaim in the Briska Shtibble. You come to the world of Hasidus, there the Rav seems overwhelmed by the masses, by the simple people striving, seeking, searching for holiness. And this is one constant theme which repeats itself time and again. Another theme which I think has great impact on the Rav's life, and it's something that I called to your attention before, Rabbi Reuben called it to your attention, and it comes back time and again, the poverty of the masses. Evidently, during the Rav's formative years, and I can't judge whether in Brisk and Volozhin there were any more wealthy than the Hasidic masses. But it could very well be that if you were in an elite corps and you were in Volozhin Yeshiva and you were studying in Volozhin and you were studying in Brisk, that somehow you had support and you were able to live with a what was considered then a basic standard of living. But then when you come to the Hasidic masses and you see their poverty, and despite their poverty, how they rise above it, how their souls soar, the Rebbe was overwhelmed by this. And this is another theme that comes back time and again. Now, I want to come to Coronation Night, which is 2.05. And in Yiddish, wait, let the young men enter. In Yiddish, it's Karanatzi Nacht. And here the Rav, I heard this from him many times. This left an indelible impression on him. And what is he talking about? Karanatzi Nacht. What is he talking about? That Chabad Hasidim call Rosh Hashanah night the night that they crown HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Where do they get the words from? They get it from a piyut that basically we say during the Chazaretz Hashatz of Musaf, where we talk about how the Chazan says this. We don't say this in the Salon Shmuel Nesrei. It's a piyut we say in the Chazaretz Hashatz. Vayatrucha neset tifara v'yivtzucha harim rina v'yitzalu yim b'malchecha v'yikablu ol malchut aleichem v'yomemucha b'kal amim v'yishmu'u rechokim v'yavol v'yitnu lecha keta malchut. And all the nations of the world, those from afar will join those up close, and they will give HaKadosh Baruch Hu a keta malchut. And here, the Rav is a kid in Cheder with Rabbi Riesberg. Here you see all the beauty of the interaction. This little kid asking an amazing question. He says to his Rebbe in Cheder, what does it mean, Karanatzi Anach? What does it mean? That's the night they crown HaKadosh Baruch Hu king. Does HaKadosh Baruch Hu need to be crowned king by human beings? He is the king. He's the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's the Melech Malchei Olamim. And what does it mean? And look at the words of the Jew. And I remember I can hear it ringing in my ears. Poor, downtrodden, impoverished Jews. You're not talking about a procession coming out of Lawrence or Woodmere or Englewood or Teaneck. Could you imagine what would be happening? The Cadillacs would be going third, the Rolls Royces would be up front, and then what comes next? I don't even know myself, the Chrysler town cars. And Ribbono Shel Olam, when's the Yiddenheim felt garnished? Now it's used today, lack for nothing, are ye? And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about poor, downtrodden Jews, impoverished, one level above starvation, hustling at all times to make ends meet. What did we call them? Luftmenschen, right? Isn't that the Yiddish? It's an amazing expression. Luftmenschen. People who lived on air. Somehow, did you ever try to live on air? People who somehow survived on oxygen alone, that they're somehow, the Luftmenschen. And they, Leil Rosh Hashanah, crown HaKadosh Baruch Hu king. And here you have that amazing description. This little beryl, this little kid, is asking his Rebbe in Cheder, Rebbe, I don't understand, he says. God needs us to crown him king? And the Rebbe gives him an answer from the Tanya, a Hasidic answer. And the Rebbe says, and it's all in here, the Rebbe says, I didn't understand the answer then. But in later years, how well the Rebbe says, now I comprehend what I did not understand as a child. Melech asur b'rochatim, the pasuk from Shir HaShirim, God is tied up in chains. Without the human, without Avraham Avinu, as great as HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, the world does not know him. And this is basic to Hasidus. This is basic to Zohar. What is the Zohar Vayakel? Yisrael v'yoraita v'kudsha berichu chadhu. And that's an amazing thought. God needs the Jewish people. I heard this from the Rav. This not now, but I heard this from the Rav many times. God needs Yisrael v'yoraita v'kudsha berichu. God needs the Jews. God is the Borei Olam. God is the Kol Yachol. God gave us the Torah. God needs us? Yes. God needs us. It's the exact same thought. V'yitnu lecha ketam malchut. Without the Jew, the world doesn't know about God. The Torah becomes meaningless. There's no one to observe it, no one to sacrifice for it, no one to study for it. And Kaviyachal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Melech Asur Berochatim, he's tied up in chains. Yisrael V'yoraita V'kudsha Berichu Chatu. And this is a beautiful piece which you can understand on Rosh Hashanah, how effectively you can use it, putting it into the language of the congregants of the Mitpalalim of today. Okay. Then we come to one of two exceptions in the book. And this to me is one of the most moving entries of all. What do I mean by exceptions? If you've read the Rav, I have over 200 direct quotes from Rebbe, either from his writings or from tapes. These are direct quotes from Rebbe. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was interview people, what do you think the Rebbe said? Not only that, I have no stories about Rebbe. It's not an Artsfield book, which, or today, there's a whole genre of literature in Israel about the Brisker Rav, about Rav Shach, about the Chazon Ish, about the Chafetz Chaim. They just came out with 3 volumes, and they collect stories people tell about them. All right. I don't know how reliable the stories are, but it's better to have these books than not to have them, but you have to read them with a certain grain of salt. I read the book on Rav Shach, and I happen to know some of the stories. I know who's involved, eyewitness accounts, and I know already how they changed and didn't let the full impact of the stories be felt, because once there has to do with Yeshiva University, it was his son, Rav Shach's son, one of his Rabbi and Kotler. Remember, Rav Shach is related to Rabbi and Kotler. Rav Shach married Rabbi Zalman's niece. Rabbaran married Rabbi Zalman's daughter, so they're cousins by marriage. And Rav Shach's son went to visit Rav Kotler on his deathbed. I know the story from 1962. I didn't have to read it in the book. I know it from F.E. direct when we learned in graduate school together. But I saw the way they wrote it up in the book already. They edit, they change. It's the last thing in the world I wanted to do. But there are two exceptions out of about 204 entries in Insights. There are two stories about the Rav that my Yetzer Hara wouldn't let me leave out, because those two stories are just fabulous. One story is a story I got from Tova Lichtenstein that will come to, if not this year, next year, Be'ezrat Hashem. But the other story is right here. Now, here you need a little bit of background. Sitting in front of me, Aryeh Plum, has a lot of negative feeling towards the Russians. The Russians that have come to Israel, the Russians that have come to America. He told me a story last week that he goes to YU and he eats treif because his Russian roommate went out and bought treif. All right, I understand the story very well. I have a different approach. I don't want to look at the Russians that eat treif and the Russians that know nothing and the Russians here in Israel that Barak wants to win the election by inciting them against Torah. I don't want to look at that, because that to me is normal. That a Russian should not have, that a Russian should be totally ignorant of Torah is as natural as breathing air. How should he know Torah? How should he know Yiddishkeit? He's totally cut off from 1917, 1989. He has no yeshiva, and he has no rabbanim, and he hasn't studied, and he hasn't learned, and he's been taught that religion is the opium of the masses, and that these are primitive paganistic rituals we do. I know the Russian mentality very well. I lived in Russia. I know Russia inside out. Believe me. But I rather want to look at the reawakening that happened in Russia. And here we have one of the greatest miracles of our times, that out of Russia today, with all the negative, which is to be expected, there are tens and tens of thousands of Shomrei Torah mitzvot, people raised on communism that return b'chol nafsham, b'chol levavam, l'torat Hashem tamima, to Mesorah, to tradition, and they have totally reintegrated with the Torah world, the Torah community, our future, ashrei ayin ratazot. And we have to keep on working further and going further. Now, how is this brought about? And here's the background of this piece. Chabad never stopped functioning in Russia. There was always a Chabad presence. Chabad paid a very heavy price under Stalin in the 20s and the 30s. Endless Chabadnikim were executed, including the Rebbe's father, who died in exile, either executed or died in exile. I don't have to tell you, if someone to exile us today to Siberia, I don't know how many of us would survive. We're used to a good life, we're used to a little heat, we're used to food, we're not used to 40, 50 degrees below zero. And I've been in Russia, I've been in Riga, which I'll never forget, when it was 30 degrees below zero centigrade. You have no idea what that means. To go out of the hotel just required endless kochat hanefesh, just to push yourself in that weather. So there always was Chabad. It was small by the time of post-Stalin era with Khrushchev, Brezhnev. They reached the modus vivendi. And it was clear to the Russian authorities that Chabad was not out to overthrow the communist empire. And they tolerated, some people need a little primitive, paganistic, old-fashioned ritual, just like they tolerated babushkas going to the Russian Orthodox Church on Sunday. They tolerated a small amount of Chabad. The few Jews that were Shomer Shabbos throughout World War II and the communist regime in Russia were inevitably almost all Chabadnikim. The few. I don't know how many there were, maybe 10, 20, 30, there were not more. Almost all of them were Chabadnikim. I can introduce you to such Jews. I know such Jews living in Yerushalayim. Absolutely so. These were Chabadnikim, and they retained the spirit, the spark, against all odds. There was a family in Leningrad, the Fradkin family, Daniel and Sarah Fradkin, and they were a Chabad family. They suffered during the Nazi siege of Leningrad during World War II. They starved. Until today, their health is not good. They were never, ever Mechallel Shabbos. They were in refusal for 12, 13 years. He was a mathematician, a bit of a scientist. Never, ever Mechallel Shabbos. Later on came the Six-Day War. Now, the Six-Day War caused a tremendous reawakening. And you have to ask a simple question. Why did the Six-Day War have such an impact? We had the War of 48, we had the War of 56. Manish Tana, the Six-Day War, from everything that happened before. And here the answer is very simple. And everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped us invent, ultimately, it works for the good of the Jew. It's about from the Chafetz Chaim. I don't have to tell you, the Chafetz Chaim said about train travel, that we today are such patlonim, if we had to travel by horse and wagon, we never have time to learn Torah. So we have trains that go much quicker, leaves us little time to learn Torah. The Chafetz Chaim is a meridik vart. When you see a television set, kiss the television set, because the television set brought about the miracle of the Six-Day War. In Russia, impoverished country, televisions cost next to nothing. You brought them through the Communist Party, you bought them at work, you paid it out a ruble a month for 30 years, no interest, no linkage. Why? The government wanted you to have a television set because if you ever saw Russian television at the time of the communists, it was filled with magnificent propaganda. Every day they would show you the worker of the day, the worker of the week, the man that did. He comes home with fish and he gives his wife fish and he's self-sufficient. Then he works in the factory from 6 in the morning to 8 at night. And he gets in. They would show you the women who get medals for having 10 children. You get a gold medal. It was propaganda. They'd show you the imperialism, Israel and America, and how the Russian system, everyone has a place to sleep at night. You have eggs and you have bread. And you have cabbage, and you have a little milk. You have nothing else, but you have the basics. It costs next to nothing. It's true. They wanted you to have a television. When the Six-Day War came, all of you know there was a tremendous 3-week waiting period. That waiting period, when NASA moved his troops into Sinai against the UN, and everyone folded, the UN and America, and everyone ran the other way, it was 3 weeks until the war broke out. Yom Ha'atzmaut to Chafvav Iyar. Now, during those 3 weeks, the whole world was glued to the television. And in Russia, they were showing the Arab armies training to wipe out Israel, to destroy all their Jews. We're on the way to Tel Aviv with joy, with glee. And they showed the streets of little Israel with 1.5 million inhabitants. No man over 16 under the age of 66 was to be seen inside. Everyone was called up and they're digging trenches. And somehow the Jew in Russia, from that TV screen, that created Yosef Begun and that created Yosef Mendelovich, Hatzadik, should live and be well. That when you mention Yosef Mendelovich, you actually have to stand. You're not allowed to be sitting when you mention his name for the first time. Know what it means to not be Mechalul Shabbos, not eat anything non-kosher in labor camp, to get matzah for Pesach, because they knew you would fast and starve to death if you didn't have matzah. That's Yosef Hatzadik Mendelovich, who lives within walking distance of where we're talking right now. This created Natan Sharansky. This created the great reawakening. Now, while this reawakening was happening, there was a Jew in Kibbutz Sad in Israel. His name is Aryeh Kroll, K-R-O-L-L, should live and be well. Came from a distinguished Litvish family, a Zionist who got out on one of the last boats to leave Russia, comes to Kibbutz Adati, goes to Kibbutz Sad, active in Bnei Akiva, active in the kibbutz, and the kibbutz, he was entitled to a trip overseas because he had lived in the kibbutz so many years. He asked the kibbutz to send him to Russia to visit his sisters. Gentlemen, every word is history. Write it down, because one day you'll have to pay to go to a movie to see this. Now you're getting it chinam within the $1,000 you laid out for the sight of my sputtik. This is a mink. This is a real Russian sputtik bought on my second trip. That itself is a story, but leave it for another time. Now, Aryeh Kroll went to Russia in 1966. Aryeh Kroll meets his two sisters who survived the Holocaust. And wherever Aryeh Kroll went, Jews were pleading with him, leave us a yarmulke, leave us a siddur, leave us tefillin. 6-day war broke out, and he's getting messages from Russia, bederech lo derech, that the people are famished. They're pleading, we want to return to the Jewish people. We want information. We want books. We want to know about Zionism. We want to know about Israel. Do what you can for us. Aryeh Kroll came up with an ingenious idea. He goes to Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion then was then in retirement. And he tells Ben-Gurion, look, we have Jews all over the world who are citizens of other countries. Why can't we send them into Russia as tourists? And if we send them into Russia as tourists, they'll be able to go as English people, as American people, as Australian people, and drop off a siddur here, a siddur there, a yarmulke here, a tefillin here, a tzitzit here, a chumash here, a book on Zionism, Menachem Begin's book, your book, recreate Jewish identity. Ben-Gurion listens, doesn't respond, says, let me think about it. A few weeks later, Aryeh Kroll gets a call from Shaul Avigur. Make believe you recognize the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Shaul Avigur was the legendary Mossad agent who ran Aliyah Bet, and with his great Mesirat Nefesh brought over to the nascent state of Israel thousands upon thousands of people out of Europe, Aliyah Bet, children, the Bricha, adults. Shaul Avigur, a legendary figure. Shaul Avigur meets with Aryeh Kroll, and they set up a special division of the Mossad, which later will become known as Nativ. It's done very ingeniously, so that it runs under the title of Misrad HaChutz, although it really wasn't Misrad HaChutz, but the idea is to protect the people. And they start turning to individuals in England and America, and they begin this tremendous mifal, this tremendous project that will continue till the communist empire falls, of infiltrating Russia with tourists, put around the tourist quotation marks. Now, one of the early people they got to is somebody who lives a few blocks from here, studying in YU, younger than you, college, post-college, smicha, a fellow by the name of Menachem Kasdan, K-A-S-D-A-N, Menachem Kasdan, raised, do you know him? He learns, comes in here occasionally, learns in the Beit Midrash, I'm told, Rabbi Dr. Menachem Kasdan today, and then just Menachem Kasdan from Washington, D.C., his father, a medical doctor from an Orthodox family from the 1800s already in America, and a family that remained from his father, born in America, medical doctor, everyone in the family from his first cousins, one I got smicha with, one I graduated college with. Menachem Kasdan was studying with the Rav. Menachem Kasdan, Bnei Akiva reaches him. This was functioning through Bnei Akiva Shlichim at the time. Bnei Akiva reaches him, and they send Menachem Kasdan to Russia. He's a shliach. And he's briefed, and he's told what he can say, what he can't say, and you're never allowed to say who sent you. You're never allowed to say that you're not really a tourist. What you're allowed to reveal is, in Menachem Kasdan's case, he was allowed to say, I study in Yeshiva University, I study with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and you throw these thoughts out, because in every shul you're walking, everywhere you're going, you are encountering KGB agents, Jews, Nebuch, who sell their souls, partially sell their souls, out to the Danielani Sayon, capos, who are agents for the KGB to get bread, to get food, to enhance their standard of living, have a bed to sleep on at night that they don't have to share with someone, etc. I need not elaborate. Now, Menachem comes to the one, the communist used the word, I'm using communist terminology now, the one functioning synagogue in Moscow. The synagogue on Akhapova Street, where I trust some of you have been. It's the Choral Synagogue. It was a very big synagogue, one of the biggest synagogues in Moscow. In downtown Moscow, it was called the Choral Synagogue because they always had a big choir in the shul. That was the one shul that the communists didn't destroy, didn't blow up. You've all seen the movies of the communists blowing up synagogues and churches. But in every city they were smart. They left one church, one synagogue functioning. People can go, people can worship. And because it's only one, the KGB or the NKVD before it can keep a close watch. Mi v'mi ha'holchem. Menachem Kasdan goes into the shul. It's 1969, I believe. 68, goes into the shul, and he goes in. If you've been in the shul, there's the big, beautiful choral synagogue. On the side is the shtibel. The shtibel basically was in the hands of old chabatnikim who yet survived. The shul was a formal shul, a regular davening. The shtibel on the side was in the hands of some from handful of Jews, some who had been from all their lives, some who came back to it. What they had in common was a basic commitment to Chabad, to the Rebbe. Menachem goes into the big shul and he announces he's from Yeshiva University, he's a tourist, he sticks out like a sore thumb, everyone jumps on him, you understand you're dressed in American clothes, they're dressed in clothes that's from the 1920s yet. So the minute you walk in, you walk on the streets of Russia and the communist year, they offer you money for your coat, they'll do anything, buy your coat, give you ruble, the ruble are worthless. What's the good? If you sell your coat, you got to buy a new one that you can't freeze. So it's, the whole thing is worthless. But Nebuch sticks out like a sore thumb, and he tells everyone he's from Yeshiva University, and he studies with Rabbi Soloveitchik. The next day, Menachem comes back to the shul, and a bearded gentleman comes out of the shtivel, and he comes over to Menachem, and the whole conversation is in Yiddish. Menachem, as I said, is a second, third generation American, speaks a broken, barely understands Yiddish. By the time he reached the Rav was in English, and this gentleman says to him, Chobigechet, as Yezaita student, Yezaita Talmud, from Maina a Talmud. I heard that you are a student of my student. And Menachem looks at him, what the heck is this guy talking about? And Menachem makes out of it, Talmud, he does. Abyssal Fashteita, yeah, a little bit he does understand. You told me last week to translate, I'm trying my best. If I don't, stop me. and I'll translate. That's your job as a student. Don't let me say anything you don't understand. You understand? I have in my mind to translate, but sometimes I get carried away and reliving it. I forget that you don't know Yiddish. You understand? So you stop me. Don't be afraid, and don't be afraid of me, Avada, and don't be ashamed. Ein Baishan Melameid. Okay, you know that. Okay, Ein Baishan Melameid. The Pirkei Avot. So Menachem, he says to Menachem, is I a Talmud from my Talmud? What are you talking about? What's Retman? What are we talking about? And finally, Menachem starts to realize this guy's a Chabadnik. This man is an old man. And he says, and he tells him, yes, I taught Rav Soloveitchik in Cheder. How is he? And Menachem says to the man, wait a minute, you taught him more Tanya than Gemara, didn't you? And this old man says, he denied it, I taught him Gemara, Tanya was only a dessert. And Menachem finally says, and he says, when you get tzedek, when you go back, shika gruz, send regards. And Menachem says, who should I send regards from? He says, zagim baruch me chaslovich, baruch from chaslovich. And he'll know who it is. Baruch from Chaslovich. Menachem comes back to YU. Okay? Everything I'm saying so far is in the book, except I'm giving you the whole story as I heard it from Menachem. In a few minutes, I'll give you something that's not in the book that simply adds 100% to it. And Menachem comes back to the Rav. And you have to know the Rav, what it was like. He had a big desk. Big desk. I remember I used to sit here. I showed you the picture. Big desk. There were four guys here, two guys here, two guys here. And here the Rav is 1968, the Rav is exhausted, he just finished shiur, he's no youngster, he's gone through triple avelut, his health is failing, he's gone through, it's been a very hard decade. The 1950s was the Rav's decade, the 1960s was not. It's been a hard decade. And Menachem goes over to the Rav after shiur, says, Rebbe, you know, and the guys are standing around, I guess you've seen the pictures in my book, there's a picture out of the 1980, that's the way it was in my time too. When the Rav finished shiur, the real fellas who held by learning didn't leave. You didn't want to let go of Rebbe, you didn't want to walk out of the room, you didn't want to leave till the Rav left, you wanted, even if he spoke about the weather, you wanted to hear what he had to say about the weather. Everything, Rebbe, I can still remember my conversation with him in 1956 on Stevenson and Eisenhower. And what he told me then, I was a kid, Habach Nishvashtan, and today I see his insight was unbelievable, how true, how accurate, So Nachum says, Rebbe, I have regards from you. The Rav looks up, I have regards. The Rav, a million people knew the Rav, a million people are sending regards. You can't expect the Rav looks up, and the Rav says, who's the regards from? And he says, Rebbe, I have regards from you, from your Rebbe, the Baruch of Measurements, of Chaslovich. And Rav suddenly becomes animated, says, What are you saying? And he repeats it. And the Rav says, It cannot be. What are you talking about? There was a Holocaust, a communist. And Menachem says to the Rav, he says, Rebbe, you always spoke about your Malamed. Did you ever tell us his name? The Rav says, no. How do I know the name? Said, a Haramalamid, a Chabadnik, what's important the name? And the Rav starts to shake. And he starts making a cheshbon. And he says to Menachem, you know, you're right, he could be in his early 80s today. How old was he when I was a kid, when I studied with him? The Rav starts making the cheshbon, 1915. Let's say the Rebbe was 30 years at that time, 35, make the cheshbon, 35 to 1968. Yeah. And the Rav was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe it. Now, here's what's not in the book. Now, this is a story Menachem Kasdan told me. As I said, there are only two stories I took about the Rav that I knew nothing about until I heard them. The story about Kasdan, I'd heard it. Floated around, but now I got right to the source. The story that Tova told me, I'd never heard before, but, all right, Tova Lichtenstein, it's Tova Lichtenstein, it's Tova Soloveitchik Lichtenstein, the daughter of an Adam Gadol, the wife of an Adam Gadol, and in her own right, an Isha Gadolah. All right. She told me, I took word by word, it had to be absolutely true. Menachem is telling a story that's just absurd. It's out of a magic storybook. A Talmud of the Rav meets his Rebbe in the shul in Moscow, the man that had such an impact on the Rav after the Holocaust, after the communists. It's unbelievable. So, when I got to Boston, right before the books were published, I went to Boston. There was a reason why. I'll be honest with you. I told it before. I tell it again. I went to Boston to ask Mechila from Rebbe. I went to Rebbe's grave. I mean, it is arrogant son, the part of a little kid from the Bronx who's still in MTA, to publish two volumes like this on the Rav, which I don't know if you're aware of, but if you see the way it's being quoted now, it's centered into the mainstream of classic literature in the Torah world. Well, Baruch Hashem. Due to my students, I succeed. It's arrogance. So I went to ask Mechila from Rebbe. If you read my introduction, you'll understand why. Once I went to Boston, Aaron will tell you, I can't exactly go to Boston without going to Maimonides, without going to the Young Israel, and without going to visit Dr. Rebbitzin Atara Tversky, at that time the widow of the Tolna Rebbe. So I went to Atara, and I asked her about this. And she told me, and this, it was too late to put in. She said, Papa came home from New York. You know, at that point already, he was spending Shabbos with the Tverskys. His wife was gone. When your first wife dies, if you've had a happy marriage, and nowadays we have to say if you had a happy marriage, because we punish Lund, what goes on in the Torah world today is beyond my comprehension. But if Chanoch, if you've had a happy marriage, what does the Gemara say in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet? If your wife dies, it's Churban Beit HaMikdash B'yamav. The Rav already was after Churban Beit HaMikdash, Nechrav Beit HaMikdash B'yamav, the Gemara says, and he was spending Shabbos with the Tverskys, and later on he moves in. Atara told me, Papa, I'm quoting, Papa came home from the yeshiva. He was so overwhelmed. She used the Yiddish word, ibigadasht. You have to understand that. Her native language with her parents is Yiddish. Ibigadasht. In English, overwhelmed. All Shabbos, all he spoke about to anyone who would listen, that my Talmud went to Russia and met my Rebbe. All he could speak about was Reb Baruch of Chaslavich. And wow, when I heard that from Atara, I felt very happy, Menashamayim Zikuni, that I perpetuated it with the written word that doesn't hold a candle to the oral word, but at least the basic story is here. And that is such a magnificent story, because this is what Torah is about. Dor l'dor yishabach masecha. The Rebbe, who the Rav sat as a little kid in his class and asked him, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu need a crown from poor, downtrodden Jews? We need it for Malach Malchei Malachim. And the Rebbe who answers him, Melech Asur Berohatim, and an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old kid, how can he even understand that? How can he start to comprehend it? I have grandsons that age. I know what a kid, I have bright grandsons. I'm not putting them down. Chas v'chalila. Bright grandsons. Go and explain to a 9-year-old kid, Melech Asur Berohatim, and how later the Rav comes to, and the Rav's Talmud goes, and he meets his Rebbe. But I have to add one more postscript. The Eibishter was mezakami. The Eibishter, you understand? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Eibishter, the one on high. Melech Elyon. Arya, I'll tell you something about my own soul. I will never lie in Yiddish. Do you know why? That's the language I received the Torah in. When I speak English or Hebrew, don't take everything I say at face value. Sometimes I'm selling you to Brooklyn Bridge and I'm not even giving you change. But when I speak Yiddish, I never lie. You'll notice that I cry more when I speak Yiddish than in English or Hebrew. You understand? So it says something to you. So the Eibishter was mezakami. I'll lay it on a postscript, Daniel. Beautiful little postscript. Atara was so happy. Yaakov Meir, you know why she was happy? Yaakov Meir, you know, just let you know, gotta let you know I know your name. Yaakov Meir Lansky, you know why she was so happy? Because She told me she always felt terrible that Menachem Kasdan, someone that had such a beautiful schut, legalot, the Rav's Rebbe, she thought he left Yiddishkeit. And the story is that Menachem Kasdan has a second cousin with exactly the same name, who was a psychologist in one of the suburbs of Boston, who is no longer from. And she thought that that was the Menachem Kasdan that had this encounter. And when I told her that Rabbi Dr. Menachem Kasdan is married into an illustrious Yerushalmi family, sits in Bayit Vagan, Lomeid Umel Melamed, Makfid Kalika Chamura, the Ton Rebbetzin, who is also the Rav's daughter, was filled with joy that she now could relate to this schut v'tzidkoto omedet la'ad. No comment necessary. Let me go further. I don't know. If I were teaching Chinese literature, I would have energy. Arya, you understand what I'm saying to you? Don't look at the negative. Look at what can be done. I got to take you to Shvat Ami and show you. And you don't speak Russian. I want you to hear 100+ students learning Torah on a high level and speaking Russian among themselves. You understand? Ashrayayin ra'at hazot. That the chazafresses, that's natural. What do you want out of them? 4 or 5 generations without a Rebbe, without Torah, without a yeshiva, without learning. What do you want out of them? It's natural. Bronfman is natural. Sharansky is the amazing exception. And by the way, someone said to me this morning, I called, of course, now that Netanyahu's hat is in the ring, I don't think my idea can get off the floor, but I called the big shots in Mizrahi. Everyone, no one tells them what they really think. Everyone wants to make Rakefet feel good. They don't want to offend because they know my heart is pure. It's a good idea, wonderful idea, makes sense, etc. But someone showed me this morning, Sharansky favors Reform Garrett. No, it's not. Sharansky favors the Nerman Commission. And I have to tell you honestly, if Rabbi Lamb, and this is what I tell you all the time, I can't get mad at Michael Melchior. I'm mad at his Rebbeim. Rebbeim Gedolei Yisrael, that have led the way, paved the way, in agreement with the Chidoniyim, Labriyut, open up places of entertainment on Shabbos, have a few buses running there. I totally, absolutely disagree. I spoke at the press conference. But I'm not mad. Melchior's a kid. Gedolei, I can't say a word. What can I say about Sharansky? El Yochum Rubinstein also is a Talmud Chacham. But if Rabbi Lamb comes from America and testifies in favor of the Nerman Commission, how can I be angry at the little people? You understand? Rabbi Lamb, this is the president of a yeshiva, Yeshivas B'Tzolchanan, Yeshiva University, Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, Mamshich Darko, you have to see what the Israeli papers wrote. Halachically, I'm too ignorant to understand how that's a solution. The Nerman Commission solution is no different than the Denver conversion. And read about Jew versus Jew by Samuel Friedman, and you'll get the whole story of the Denver conversion. And I can tell you, Eidut Ne'mana, in the name of Rabbi Emanuel Holzer, who yet was zeicher to hear the Rav discuss it, and these were in the Rav's waning years, and the Rav was totally, absolutely, completely opposed to it. Anyone who's a Talmud Chacham, how does it get off the floor? How can you have a conversion? Conversion is not a form, it's a norm. You understand? To go to mikvah and have a brit milah, go to mikvah does not a Jew make. Kabbalat mitzvah, in addition to the form, that creates a Jew. But if there's no Kabbalat mitzvah, if you have a conservative rabbi teaching who doesn't believe Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov Avinu exist, and Kachrachu didn't give us the land, and he's teaching too, and you have a reform guy teaching who believes that this woman, who's not even Jewish, whose father was Jewish, her mother was not, and she's a lesbian, and she has ordination from Hebrew Union College, that's a rabbi, Ribbono Shel Olam. What do we have in common? What can we talk about? How can we debate? I mean, I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I'm sorry. I was destroyed by the Rav. I'm not any smarter than my Rebbe. The Rav, to be friends, absolutely. To be decent, absolutely. To discuss the general problems facing the Jewish people, how to survive the UN, how to survive the onthrust of the Arab nations, how to have money for Israel, how to fight anti-Semitism, absolutely. Theological issues to discuss. Lo dachid acheichem, v'lo machshevotai machshevoteichem, ki kasher gavayim mishum haaretz, can go, please, what do we have? Now, someone here told me that a Rosh Hashiva, and why you said that you can believe that Avram Yitzchak, that these are allegories, Maybe he was quoting Philo. There's a whole literature on Philo. I can't believe Rosh Hashiva said that. But if I've asked for the name privately, and I'll check it out when I'm in New York. I have direct sources. My colleagues in YU, the older Rosh Hashiva, all my colleagues, my bosom buddies, I'll find out already. But I can't believe it. It's impossible. Find Shalom on Philo itself. There's a whole machloket. Was he from? Wasn't he from? Was it epic? Wasn't he? Endless literature. Because he has in his parish a lot of allegories. Did he really believe the allegories? Did he put it in? Is it just another type of a medrash? All right, Beseda. But Bisman Hazet, to come out, unless the statement is being quoted out of context. But as far as I know, in Yeshiva University, the Rosh Yeshiva, Kedoshim, and Tahorim, and Tamid Chachamim, and Makpidim B'Mitzvot, Kalaka Kamuri, Yerayim, V'Shleim, and Ritvani Shalalim, it's why you were talking about. As far as the Rosh Yeshiva, I know, it's Ritz we're talking about. I don't know. Okay, I check it out, but you have to give me more detailed information. 2.07. Now, this is a very important entry. And here's where the world will be misled, and I want to put this on record. Look, what people say for newspaper interviews are not necessarily truth. All of us, including the Rav, when we have to face the public, have to be... Anyone know? I don't see him. I haven't seen him already in 2-3 weeks. Moshe Shaket is at the hospital, I would gather. David Green. Effie, I changed the name yesterday. I gave you one reason and I gave you two reasons yesterday. Now I'm giving you a third reason. Who was David Green? Eitan. At least I have one thing to know. Eitan, a pleasure to have you. David Ben-Gurion's original name is David Green. Now I asked you, Effie, knowing that, do you want Effie Green or Effie Tchelet? Which is it? Effie Tchelet. Eli Babish. Uri Grossberg. Hanoch Davidman. Seth Schenker is ill. Ira Eben is in the States. Yaakov Meir Lansky. Aryeh Blum. Joshua Sperry Rand. Barry Goldfisher. Mordechai Kaplan. Hanoch Davidman. Did I call your name? You're okay. As long as you're on the list. Okay. Back here. I warned you yesterday. I told you. I said the best reason is yet to come. Kala Kavod, Eitan, how did you know that? You know, if people know that today, everyone thinks Ben Gurion was Rakefet, was born Rakefet. You understand? I told you the story. Someone went to my brother in Petach Tikva, had an eye problem. And his back then, I said, go see this guy in Petach Tikva. He's the leading expert in Israel on this problem. So my brother has the guy in the chair, and my brother says to him, what do you do? So the young man says, well, I study in the Gris Kollel in Jerusalem. So my brother says, oh, you must have my brother as a Rebbe. The kid says, no, I don't have any Rothkopf. And my brother says, no, you don't you have Aaron Rakefet? Oh, Rabbi Rakefet. The kid jumps out of the chair. And my brother says, with such cover he stood up, how can I sit when you mention his name? And my brother says, that's my brother. That's my brother. Gentlemen, when you're interviewed, even the Rav has to pull his punches. 1967. Let me record this for posterity. I went to be Menachel the Rav. I was already a Rosh Yeshiva in YU. And my students were in Chavruta preparing. And it was early in the morning. It was like 9:15. And I went across the street to be Menachem Avil Rebbe. His mother died. And I figured I'll be Menachem Avil early because afterwards I say Shir and I have to go back to Maplewood where I was rabbi. Remember, I wore two hats at that time. So I was zeicher to come into Rebbe when he was all alone. And while I'm talking with Rebbe, in walked two chabadnikim from the old generation, Rabbi Gordon and Rabbi Jacobson. These were two close gaboyim of the Rebbe. Rabbi Jacobson, both of them were people who had never touched their beards down to the floor, chabadnikim out of White Russia, the snow was still on their beards if you look closely. That's the image they conveyed. Rabbi Jacobson's son is the editor of the Allgemeine Journal. That's the Jacobson you know of today. Rabbi Yochanan Gordon's son is Rabbi Shalom Dovber Gordon of Irvington, New Jersey, Maplewood, New Jersey. These are Chabadnikim, born, bred, Nishkevarna, born into it. Not Johnny come lately's. They walk in, the rabbi saw such derecherets, and they said, the Rebbotans geschickt, wie der Rashishiva versteht, the Rebbe geht nicht aus von 770. The Rebbe sent us, the Rashishiva understands, meaning the Rav, that the Rebbe doesn't leave 770. You all know by the mid-50s already, the Rebbe never left 770. Never took a minute's vacation. Who the Rebbe was, it's indescribable. He never left, Pashut, I understand it. His time was so precious. So at that point, the Rebbe was yet Masada Kedushin. If you wanted to get married with the Rebbe, Masada Kedushin, the Kedushin had to be at 770, and then you went to the hall where the Simcha was. Later already, the Rebbe stopped being Masada Kedushin, because Kanein Hara, there were tens of thousands of Chabadnikim. There was just no time in the Rebbe's life. The Rebbe stopped Yechidus by the late 60s, early 70s. You can't get Yechidus with the Rebbe anymore, because there's no time, all right? This is the reality. That's why he hands out the dollar bills, so anyone could pass him on a Sunday morning and speak to the Rebbe for a half second. For a chassid, just to see the Rebbe for a half second was invigorating, inspiring. So after they left, the Rav turned to me. And I have to tell you, every word that's in this interview is what the Rav told me privately in 1967. And what I'm trying to say is that in this interview, you have to absolutely take it at face value, because there is nothing in here that the Rav didn't tell me b'chadei chadarim in 1967. And the Rav was a tremendous fan of the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe. That the Rav interacted with Chabad, that the Rav knew Chabad. This is all in the interview. The interview is with Mariv in 1977. At that time, you have to remember, 1970s was the decade of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe begins in Crown Heights. He takes over from the 6th Rebbe in 1950. It's 1951 to be exact, because there was 1 year of Machlokas where there was no Rebbe yet. It was like Bush versus Gore. One full year it lasted, if you know the history of Chabad, but the Hasidim really count the new Rebbe's ascension to the throne, as from the moment the Rebbe died, he became the Rebbe, and the 1970s was a little Hasidus. What was Lubavitch in Crown Heights? Small, a few thousand. The 60s, the Six-Day War, the Tefillin campaigns, and by the 70s, the Rebbe is all over the world. Tens and tens of thousands of Hasidim. And now in Israel, the stories are legendary. All the Israelis go to America, bum around, picked up by Chabad. Thousands, thousands upon thousands of Israelis became through Chabad in the United States. As a matter of fact, if you walked into the center, which I did when I was there in the 70s, my students took me in. And I already was a personality in Jerusalem, so I had a little protexia. When you walked into the control room where they were broadcasting all over the world, telephone then was not satellite, but telephone hookups all over the world, tens of people working it. The only language they spoke to each other was Hebrew. These were all Israelis from the Israeli army, all people who knew Kesha, all people who were in communications for the Israeli army. And here they were, fellows who left Israel with no Shabbos, no Kashrut, no Tarat Mishpacha, and here they were, Hasidim Mehashura HaRishona, 100%. Now, and I call your attention again, in Reb Shimon Deutsch's two volumes on the Rebbe that have come out so far, the Rebbe, Bigger Than Life, Reb Shimon Shol Deutsch, it's a breakaway from Chabad. He's a Chabadic from the old school. He calls himself today the Liozhner Rebbe. He has a shtibble, Borough Park is stretched down on both sides. On one side, Borough Park is stretched out to Flatbush. On the other side, it's stretched out to Maimonides Hospital, if you know Borough Park. He's on the side right near my Maimonides Hospital, about a block and a half away. He has a shtibble. People come to see him. He's a Rebbe. He's a very fine Talmud Chacham, a very intelligent, insightful individual. Now, in his volume on the Rebbe, he quotes the Rav as putting the Rebbe down, as being choishish, that the Rebbe was Mashiach. I just mentioned this again. I spoke about it a few months ago, but I want to put it into context. He quotes Chaim Soloveitchik. These quotes are unfair to the Rav. Chaim Soloveitchik committed a scholarly error here. He unknowingly, I hope unknowingly, transferred his feelings to his father. that you have every right to be pro or anti-Lubavitch, fine. To transfer them to someone else is not proper from the point of view of scholarship. And, excuse me?
From the point of view of scholarship, you have to state clear out that the man lied.
Okay. Rabbi Rubin wants to put on the tape that Chaim Soloveitchik lied. I want to put it that strongly because I'm a lamed zchut that maybe he really didn't realize. Maybe he thought, you understand, maybe he, you know what, probably, I can tell you what happened. When you want me to tell you? All right, I'll tell you. Eitan, I'll give you an example of what happened. Eitan, I don't want to get involved in this now, but I'll give you a small example. Eitan has two uncles, among many other uncles, but two uncles who mishamish the Rav with all their heart and soul. His father's younger brothers, David and then Barry. Now, when the Rav went to the Fabrengen in 1980, the famous Fabrengen, which I have video clippage of and have pictures in my book, so Barry was in the car, a whole group took him, and his gabayim, his closest students, almost everyone in that car was a Talmud of mine too. So I heard the story. When they got back, the Chaim came into the Rav a day or two later, and he gave the Rav Musa why he went to a Chabad Fabrengen. So the Rav sort of didn't answer him as if to say, well, you were right, maybe, you know. Say that. Chaim walked out thinking, probably the Rav didn't want to offend his son. You understand, he knew from where it was coming, he knew where his son stood. All right, so he nodded his head, and as I said, he gave a politically astute head nod. But I want to be melamed zchut in Chaim. I don't know if he lied outright. Halacha l'maaseh, he lied. And Deutsch told me, I had sat with Deutsch many hours, on many things, because Deutsch got in touch with me, and after my article appeared in Tradition, I cited certain sources, where did you get them? And I was very impressed with Deutsch. And I told Deutsch, look, you were misled by Chaim, because poor, the Lajna Rebbe said, you know, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik spent a few hours with me, and I could see how impressed he was. Chaim, alright, I don't want to put Chaim down, chas v'chalila. But I said, on this issue, he misled you. And I went and I had two people call Deutsch, because one thing, you can say, Aaron Rakefet is, I've been called a fanatic, I've been called a people here. One guy said to me, you learned in Lakewood, you love the Haredim. I love the Haredim. I don't hate any Jew that's a Teredic Jew. I try to understand them. When I see in Machon Lev, when I entered the building yesterday afternoon to say Shia, and 50 guys in beards and payas are walking out, studying here for a bachelor's degree, I love Machon Lev and I love them. What do you want of me? I love Torah. I love Torah. They're getting bachelor's. I feel bad that the Haredim have to hide from the big world. What are you afraid about? They will come out and have to come back. That's their educational system. They retreat. Come out with dignity. We have nothing to fear. We have the greatest score in the world. Tamu Rut Kitov, Torah Hashem Tamima. And so I've been accused of everything in the world. So I was worried. Maybe Deutsch would think, well, Rakevet has a weak spot for Hasidus, you understand. I had Rabbi Shalom Ber Kowalski call him, who's a Gera by birth. And I had Roy Albert call him. These are two people who knew the Rav intimately. And they called and told him, Rakevet is right, Chaim misled you. And this interview to the Mariv, the Rav said word by word what he told me in 1967, word by word. And here, I just call your attention, the New York Times. Look on page 158, the next to the last paragraph. These last two paragraphs are extremely revealing. The last two paragraphs. And here you have to understand what the New York Times means. Gentlemen, you heard yesterday that Effie Techeles' original name was Greenhorn. A greenhorn comes to America. A greenhorn can barely read English. When a greenhorn starts to read, what papers do they buy? Look at the Borough Park. You couldn't get a New York Times. You get a Daily Snoot. You get a New York Post. Low level. The Daily Snoot never had articles where they had more than a monosyllabic word. You understand? You're dealing here. Ah, oh, but a person who reads the New York Times, that's America. That's acculturation. Rev Moshe Feinstein used to sit every morning, are you aware of this, and read the New York Times. This was acculturation. This was achievement. The New York Times ain't Kleinigkeit. Now, hear what the Rav said. He said to me in 66, he says it here, 11, 60, 10 years later, it's exactly the same thing. The Lubavitcher Rebbe
put Yiddishkeit into the New York Times.
And here he says it, that in the past, New York Times only cite the viewpoints of representatives of Reform Judaism, later conservative, who cared about orthodoxy. That they're a vestige that's going to disappear. They're a weed. They're leaves that have fallen. And Lubavitch came along, and they're interviewed, and they have spokesmen, and they run advertisements, and they speak English. And then the last paragraph, the Rav reveals himself as well. And here's the way the Rav differed with many other Litvish Gedolim in America. This is where the Rav differed with Rav Aaron Cutler. This is so different than Meiselman's portrayal of his uncle, the Rav, that he was really a Rav Aaron Cutler, but he came a few years earlier, so he couldn't be as extreme as well if you read the article in Tradition. And here the Rav says, I share something in common with Chabad. We don't give up on any male and female out there who don't belong to our camp. And of course, what the Rav is talking about, and he says it here too, the college campuses. Chabad went on every college campus. How did Shlomo Karbach get a start? The Rebbe Karbach was a Yekka who learned in Litvish Yeshiva at Karlbach, Germany. Yekkeit of Yekkeland, graduates of Hildesheim, his father, all his uncles, a magnificent family, mostly wiped out by Hitler. He learns in Chaim Berlin Lakewood, and then he becomes a Chabadnik. And the Rebbe sends him to college campuses. That's how he got his good start. Go to college campuses, go with the guitar, go and entertain, go and sing, go and be makar of them to Torah. And this is Chabad. And the Rebbe says, I agree, we don't give up on any boy or girl, any man and woman on the college campuses, not in our camp, distant from Yiddishkeit. We must ignite the spark until a full appreciation for Torah. Okay. We come to Warsaw. We come to Warsaw, and in this piece, 208, is the most magnificent insight, in my humble opinion, that God privileged me to publish. Now, what was Warsaw? Warsaw, Poland, was the hotbed of Hasidus. Polish Jewry formed 10 to 11% of the population of Poland. Out of this very distinct minority, perhaps the majority were Hasidim. If not the majority, by the interbellum period, certainly very close to the majority. And there, of course, you had great dynasties. Ger, the biggest of all. Ger was a suburb of Warsaw. And look what the Rav describes here. Look at this first. He's talking about holiness. This is from a Tshuva Drasha in 1974. He's talking about yearning and seeking. And the Rav says, Erev Shvuas. Now let me just say a word about Hasidus, for those of you that don't know Hasidus. Part of being a Hasid is to see your Rebbe occasionally. Obviously, if a chassid can see the Rebbe every day, that's the greatest. That's why so many Jews moved this Eastern Parkway, and that's why when they knew the Rebbe would be walking, the Rebbe was on a time schedule like a clock, they knew when he would be walking from his house to Daven Shachris, tens and tens would line the streets just to look at the Rebbe. They knew when the Rebbe was coming back from the cemetery, there'd be a few hundred people. You had to see it. 200 people as a Litvak, you know, what's going on here? You're being about the Torah. For them just to catch a glance of the Rebbe, and the Rebbe walked. He didn't look at anyone. I don't know if you know if the Rebbe walked. He walked. Suddenly, they tell a story of Shlush. He was Makubal from the Tanya. He's no longer alive. He was there. He went to see them, and he was standing outside. He was told the Rebbe's coming back from the Sotay. The Rebbe's walking, not looking. Suddenly, the Rebbe looks right at him and speaks to him, and the Rebbe walks on. And the Hasidim jumped on him. Who are you? And how did the Rebbe know? And he said, while the Rebbe was walking past me, I was giving him a bracha al pi Kabbalah in my mind. And the Rebbe heard the bracha and turned to me. No, go and refute the story. There are eyewitnesses to the story. So Hasidim who don't live so close would love to see the Rebbe on Shabbos. Hasidim who live further away, Shlosh Regalim. At the very least,
every chassid made an effort to be with the Rebbe. Can anyone tell me when? No? Shvuas. Why Shvuas? Zman matan Torateinu. You get the Torah. You get the Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You got your Torah from the Rebbe. Shvuas, I must be with the Rebbe. And you can check this out until today in Ger. Thousands come in from Europe. Hundreds from America. Money is cheap today. The Gera Chassidim in Antwerp can buy and sell the whole country. They certainly can come in for Shavuos. In America, there are plenty of Gera. Charter a flight, charter a plane. The Quads, Bills, Gera, mobbed on Shavuos. The Rav describes he's living in Warsaw. How old is he when he reaches Warsaw? He's a teenager. He's 17. He's 18. How on Erev Shavuos he would go to the Gera Koleka. Gera Koleka, I challenge you to find out the meaning. You know how I found it out? My neighbor, Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, and his wife, Batsheva Zichrona Levracha, Tzadeket, formerly a Soloveitchik. She was married Bezivik Rishon to the Rav's youngest to the Rav's younger brother Shmuel, Bezivik Sheni to Rabbi Hutner. She died about 2 years ago. Since then my building is orphaned. She was the heart of the building, the joy of the building. What an Isha Gadola. And they told me what it means. It's a Polish word, Koleka. And they explained to me what it means. Warsaw, a big city, big train station. Then to the suburb of Gera, there was a little train that you changed to. That was called in Poland Koleka. And the one that went to Gera, because so many Hasidim went on it, was called the Gera Koleka. And the Rav described how he would see the Jewish masses coming in Erev Shabbos. They were already dressed for Yontif. They already were washed up. I would see wealthy Jews dressed in beautiful new satin clothes. I would, in the satin kapotas, poor Jews dressed in torn old clothes, all rush breathlessly and excitedly to catch the train in order to reach Gera on time. Whoever has not observed the sight cannot understand what Judaism is. This is the longing for Kedusha. This is the natural longing that every Jew feels. Now, he quotes Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. I don't know if the quote is exact. I have a footnote, and in the footnote I indicate that the quote, if you check me out, you'll see that the quote was a little bit different. I say compare. The Rav here, but it reveals the Rav's soul. And I told you this last week in a different context. The Rav said this in a Chabad from Brangin on Yud Tet Kislev in Boston at the end of the 1960s. The Rav here, he says, if only a mitnaged could have a Rebbe as well. We lack this feeling, the seeking, the searching, the traveling. Where does it you go? You learn in a shir, you study with a Rebbe. How many boys studied in the Kollel 2-3 years over the last 2.5 decades? And then they move on. No one comes back to visit. Very few come back to visit. A chassid. And the Rebbe quotes from Yisrael Salanta. Even mitnagdim need a Rebbe. However, the problem with the mitnagdim is that they are too critical. And as a result, do not find one. And boy, that's an amazing comment. What Rabbi Yisrael Salanta said, the quote that I know, the quote that Rabbi Dov Katz, that the Bible and the Tanuat HaMusa quotes, is a little bit different. The quote is, Hasidim think they have a Rebbe, and Mitnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe, and they are both wrong. I repeat, that's the quote I refer to when I say compare. Hasidim think they have a Rebbe, Mitnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe, and Rabbi Yisrael, who had a sharp, sarcastic insight, pauses and he says, Unbeide machen atayis. They are both wrong. And here you see the rub, this beauty, the longing, the seeking, the searching, the going, the joy. They're approaching. And we lack it. We're too critical. No one is good enough for us. No one can be a Rebbe, understand? You just heard Rabbi Reuben use the word, the big L, a liar. This is a mitnaged, understand? Critical. Be honest. Be truthful. And as a result, we knock down all our idols. We chop them down. Now, on page 160 and 208, here the Rav reaches his heights.
the poverty. Who was his father? He says, we lived 2-3 houses away from a Machitz de Shtibel. I don't have to tell you what Machitz Hasidus is. That was very big in Poland. That was a Hasidus, the Taub family, the Taub family, the Taub family. In English it's Taub, T-A-U-B. In Yiddish it's Taub. In Hebrew it's Tov. There is a Taub in the world who's not a direct descendant of the Machitz de Rebbe today. The Machitz de Rebbe is in Bnei Brak. He moved from North Tel Aviv to Bnei Brak. This is a dynasty built upon song, upon music. Every Rebbe was a composer. Some of the Rebbeim composed 300 Nigunim, 500 Nigunim, 700 Nigunim. The Rebbeim led the service, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Every Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they introduced the new Nigun. And we, today, we sing so many Nigunim that are much as Nigunim. Hamar Abdil Ben Kodesh Lachal, Chatoteinu Hu Yimchal. Zareinu v'kaspeinu yabekachal v'katal v'sishayla. It's all matches, one after another. Mizmar le'David. It's all matches, one after another. Ishet chayil, one after another. The Rebbeim. Oh, what a story. So the Rav lived 2 doors away from the matches of Shtibel. How did he live? Then the Rav explains. The Hasidim were very poor. They lived in the poorest section of Warsaw. My father could not afford to live in a more affluent area. And it's the Grubozka district. This is where the poverty was. This is where the shtibel was. And the Rav describes these simple people, the porters. They carried his description of the coolie, how they would carry a bookcase, a little guy, you'd see a big bookcase walking with 2 little feet sticking out. And the Rav's description here is just epic making. And how he describes on her Shabbat, he didn't recognize these Jews. And with their tzaristna bekishes and the Rav's magnificent description that it had more stitches, more repairs than original material. He didn't know what you could call it anymore. Was it a cloak? Was it a cloak? Was it a kapot that was ripped and tattered and shred and sewn and re-sewn? And then the Rav comes. This is my most favorite part. And this is the Rav. He knew how to put himself down. He didn't have that tremendous self-centeredness and ego. This is not Otsko. The Rav knew how to put himself down. And the Rav describes how one Motzei Shabbos, he comes in from his father's house, comes into the shtibel. Shabbos was long since over. The stores are ready. It's here. The stores are ready. Were opened in the Litvisher area, the Misnagdim. And he comes into the shtibel. They're singing B'nei Chachalim. They're B'nei Chachala. They're still in the middle of Sudash Shlishit. They're still singing Mizmar LeDavid, Hashem Roi. They're in ecstasy. And, you know, it's Saturday night. You want to daven Maariv. You want to go back to your weekday activities. And he comes and he asks this poor chassid that he knew from during the week. And here he is in his Shabbos finery, his beautiful, beautiful shtreimel, once a week, a king, a prince. And he asks him, "Ven vet men davenim marav? When are we going to daven marav?" And this chassid looks at the Rav and he says, "Vasi yingo, du banks noch in vach? What's the matter with you, youngster? You long for the week? You long for the weekday? You're in a rush to get rid of Shabbos?" And the Rav said, "What I learned from this man, what I gained, this is the Kedusha, this is the yearning, the love, the sanctity, this is the Chassid. This is why the Jew, the Chassid, is so sad that he has to leave the Shabbat, that he has to give it up." And finally, in 209, here the Rav went into a whole description in Tosfat Kedusha, Tosfat Shabbat. And here, this is something unique to the Rav. Rabbi Lichtenstein calls our attention to this. I've spoken about this so many times over the decades. Rabbi Lichtenstein was the first one to do an article on Rabbi Soloveitchik. It was the early 60s. He did the article for the B'nai B'rit series, Great Jewish Thinkers of the 20th Century. And Rabbi made the point that besides being a Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, the Rav did something that no one else has attempted to do in modern times. And that is, he took halachic concepts and developed philosophical, theological positions based upon halachic concepts. He took the halacha and turned the halacha into a guidebook for us to understand what is Torah, what is Hashkafa, what is Judaism, what is the philosophy. Now, what does this remind you of? Well, Uri, what was the great plan of the Rav? No, the halachic mind. Not the halachic man, but the halachic mind. Where the Rav had this great vision, he was going to take all the halacha and interpret it philosophically, theologically, and give us an entire Weltanschauung of what a Torah Jew is. And he, unfortunately, lo zachinu, we only have the introduction. But here you have one example. He takes the concept of Tosfat Shabbat. The Gemara, Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tet Omer Aleph, Tosfat Shabbat. All of us know that Chas V'Chalil, if sunset is 5:39, that we're going to stop all Malachar at 5:38. Chas V'Chalil. Mosifin Me'achol Al HaKodesh. We do it before Shabbat, and we do it after Shabbat. There isn't a Jew in the world, Yerushalayim, that has the highest level of Kedusha, Minig Yerushalayim, where Makabel Shabbos, we start already licht benching 40 minutes before Shkiah. Where else do you find that minig? Who can tell me? Petach Tikva. Why in Petach Tikva? Because Petach Tikva was founded by people from Yerushalayim. It's the Shtamfa family. These are all Tamidei Hagra. It's all the Rivlin family. It's all Litvakin Mitnagdim from Yerushalayim HaKodesh who went to Petach Tikva and continued in Petach Tikva Minig Yerushalayim. So in Petach Tikva you will find the old timers who understand what Petach Tikva was. Light candles just like Yerushalayim 40 minutes before. The Johnny come lately, so don't know what Petach Tikva was, and it just caught up with Petach Tikva of the 21st century. They light candles like the rest of Israel 18, 20 minutes before. But this is the concept of Tosfot Shabbat, and as you recall, Reb Moshe Feinstein had his face washed in mud by a yenter on the east side who looked out of her window after licht benching and saw Reb Moshe being driven to the Tiferet Yerushalayim when she already benched licht. And she called him, and she rebuked him. V'ken the Rosh Yeshiva, I lit candles already, and the Rosh Yeshiva is being driven in a car. You understand? And that woman, Reb Moshe answers, he had his face washed in mud, and he agrees, Ma'ika Hadin, he's right, but a Jew has to understand the longing, the yearning, the Tosfat Kedusha. Now, here the Rav has this amazing story. It's a continuation. This he said at an RCA midwinter conference in 1973, and it's a continuation, or it's an introduction, it's a continuation, it's the same thought expressed in the Tshuva Drasha of 1974. But here he tells an amazing story, that he comes into the shtibble, and it's the Majlis, the shtibble, and here he says, I don't remember exactly, it probably was the Majlis, the shtibble, and they were singing at the Misnagdish Shabbat Medrash. The Shabbat was already open, over, the stores were open, and in the Hasidish shtibble, the B'nai Chachala, the Hashem Rawi, and there was a short little Jew standing there, and he was wearing a satin kapata. There were more holes in the kapata than the threads in it. He was so mesmerized and enchanted by the singing of Hashem Rila Aksa that I could not recognize, I couldn't identify. And here's the Rav, this teenager, this Soloveitchik, looking at this chassid, this little chassid, a tzedusin of Bekisha, ripped and sewn and sewn and ripped. There were more threads. What a description, magnificent. And then this little man comes over to the Rav and he says, do you recognize me? And the Rav says, no. And he says, what do you mean you don't recognize me? Every day you walk past the Iron Gate in the famous square where all the porters gather. And the Rav suddenly starts to think. And yes, he sees who this Jew is. He sees him during the week. And he can't recognize him. Now, I did my research. What does it mean? The Iron Gate, where all the porters gather. The Rav was speaking here quickly. Iron Gate, porters. What was he talking about?
And Rabbi Huttner told me, look, in Warsaw, there was a famous gate. It was a landmark. A big iron gate in the center of the city. When you needed a porter, you went to that gate. It was like a taxi station. If you need a taxi, you go to a taxi stand. If you needed a porter, you went to that gate. That's where people were waiting to be employed. If you needed a porter, that's where you got someone to schlep for you, someone to bring move furniture, someone to bring water, someone to carry for you. That's where you found the porters. And evidently that gate was near the poor Jewish quarter. That's where these Jews who were uneducated, didn't have degrees, weren't graduates of Machon Lev, weren't graduates of Yeshiva University, weren't graduates of Reitz, had no degree. What could a Jew do? He learned to be strong, learned to carry, learned to schlep, learned to become a porter. And the Rav evidently walked by there every day on his way to school, on his way to cheder, on his way to college. He may have been in college already. He went to college in Warsaw, may have been in college already. And this Jew knew the Rav. And the Rav couldn't recognize him. And finally, he did not want to part with the role of a prince that he played just 25 hours every week. And look at the Rav's words. He refused to return to the profane of bleakness, dreariness, and nausea, and instead tried to extend the Shabbat as much as possible. The halacha of Tosfot Shabbat reflects and mirrors this longing of the Jew. And the Rav once said something else that I add on here. I have it elsewhere in the book, but it has to be added right here. This will explain to you something else, see? We Litvakin, very Matpid. Tachlin, Monday, Thursdays, long Tachlin. A chassid by nature recoils from the recitation of Tachlin. Did you ever wonder about that? You ever done in a Hasidic shul? You go into Boston and in Harnof, I'll be davening this afternoon. Be'ezrat Hashem, there's a sign up. Anyone davening for the Yomer has to wear a hat, a gartel, and he's not allowed to say Tachnun at Mincha. Not allowed to say Tachnun at Mincha. You ever go into a Hasidic shul? They have Luchat, where every day you have the yotzeit of a Rebbe. Ribbono shel Olam, there have been many Rebbeim, many Rashi Yeshiva, many Talmidei Chachamim. Every day on the calendar you can find the yotzeit. You have it down in the Hasidic Shtibl? They get the clap, they give a bang. Heint is the yotzeit from the Chelek Arushin Rebbe. Min zak nish kein tachlun. Finished. No tachlun. So of course, a Litvak is angry, he's upset, he quotes the Rambam, you all know the Rambam, I know it from the Rav, I know it from my own learning, the Rambam holds Nefil at the Paim, you know what I'm talking about? It's a Kiyam in Shmon Esrei, that when you are Nofel at Paim, it's not just Tachnun, the Tachnun is a Kiyam in the Shmon Esrei, the Rav gave Drashit on it, the Rambam is Medayek, it's one of the 10 things that you must do to fulfill Shmon Esrei, and the Rav explained, here you stood before God, Daniel Price thinks he's a big man, Price and Waters, he has a big firm, he's wealthy, he's throwing people around, he's on top of the world, he stood before God, you understand, Sperry Rand, I don't have to tell you, I have a girl, Merrill Lynch in Midrashit Moria, big shots! When you finish Shmon Esrei, you stood before God, you have to fall Tachnun to show that you are humble, that with all you've said and all you stood and all you directly addressed the Kaddish Baruch Hu, who are you? Nothing, but no, God, Chatati, Pashati, Aviti, who are you? Shamti, Bogadati, you understand? It's a meritic thought. The literature, but the Chassid Tachnun, nausea, the Rav's word, weekday. Dreariness, bleakness. It takes away from the joy of existence, the joy of life, the chedvat achayim, the simchat achayim. And that's why, whenever a chassid could, he tried to get out of the saying of Tachnun. Philosophically, it makes a lot of sense. The Hasidic lifestyle makes a lot of sense. As a Litvak, very hard for me not to say Tachnun, particularly in Shachris. Mincha, I'll have to admit to you, I grew up without saying Tachnun. Why you, in our time, never ever did they say Tachnun at Mincha. We used to daven, upgedaven quick, had to run to college. I mean, with Rashi Yeshiva, Gedolei Yisrael, Ashrei, Chatzikadish, Hecha Kedusha, Shmon Esrei, Kaddish Shalem, Aleinu, and up the class. One or two Rebbeim, Talmidim of the Rav, when they started teaching, were very makpid that their Talmidim should make a Chazaras Hashatz, because the Rav felt that a Hecha Kedusha was only b'di'evid, under anxiety, under tension, the late Breira. But otherwise, you must stay a regular Shmon Esrei. So wanted to remember Rabbi Macy Gordon when he started teaching Talmud of the Rav, learned Brachot with the Rav in the 50s. Rabbi Moshe Macy Gordon was makpid, the students should say Chazaras Hashatz. There was another reason too. A kid has to learn Ivra. You understand? This way it becomes second nature. Then when you become a chazan, you don't embarrass yourself. You know Ivra. It's not Israel. Israeli kids know Ivra because it's the language. They speak it, they live it, they talk it, they fight in it, they maledict in it. It's the language. But in America, it's far the foreign language. It's far. It's still a different language. It's a different... And if you have Chazaras Hashatz, the kid becomes a zaken v'ragil. But in my days in yeshiva, mincha meila, I don't say tachlin, hatminisht, but shachris, whenever I daven in a shtibble, and in America I daven in a shtibble a lot because I spend part of the year in Borough Park, and whenever they give this clap, this bang, and a yard sight of this and that, I go along with it. I don't want to be an idiot and fall tachlin and make myself like a lahachisnik. But on the other hand, when I think of the Rambam, it troubles me. When the little Hasidic soul in me comes to the fore, it somehow compensates for the troubled feeling. But you see, with all this description, look what the stress is on. The simple Jew, the ripped Bekesha, the porters, the Wasserträger, the water carriers, didn't have water in their house, used to carry big pitchers of water. The guy carrying this big bookcase, this big aron, how do you say it in English, the closet. It's like Israel. They didn't build closets into the wall. You had to build your own closets afterwards. These simple Jews. And look at the Rav's feeling. Look at the Rav's description. The Tosfot Shabbos, the longing, the yearning, the story with that much it's a chastad. I tell you, I cannot top it. For a story that conveys feeling, emotion, Yiddishkeit, understanding who we are, what we are, this is what it's all about. Vasi Yinkel, du bangst noch ein Wach. And you see, the Rav wasn't ashamed to put himself down, slap himself in the face. It's not art school. We're human beings. These are cultures in conflict. These are Jews out of the ghetto. How do we live? How do we go? How do we develop? What do we stress? What do we teach? And that's an amazing encounter. The brisker Einikel and a Majid's the Chassid telling him off, what's the matter with you? You long for the weekday. You're in a rush to get out of the shul. You're in a rush to finish Shabbos. And how well the Rav understood these people. What did they have all week? Who were they? What were they? Porters, Wasserträger, water carriers. Who were they? And here on Shabbos, B'nei Malachim, they were sons of God. They were angels. They had monarchy. They had royalty. Why leave it? Why rush away from it? It's a fabulous description. The Rav living on the poor neighborhood. And I'll tell you, B'didi Havayuvda. B'didi Havayuvda, in Borough Park a few summers ago, I drove my wife to the library. The library right near the police station. Those of you who know Borough Park, 59th Street, wherever it was. 57th, you can correct me, but somewhere in that, right there. So I parked the car and I went into the library, and lo and behold, in Borough Park, a big section of Jewish books right in front, and I take a look, a picture book of Warsaw, and I open up the book. And the first page I turn to is Grabajska Street. It means Street of the Mushrooms. The very street on which the Rav describes that he lived and that this happened. And I said, I broke into tears. I look like an idiot. I opened the book up. Guy's crying. All right, Mela. In America, everything goes. But I said, Minishamayim, take a look what I opened up to. And you see that feeling, and it comes across time and again, the drushes, the talks. This was a part of the Rav we didn't know when we were learning Shas and Paiskim. Now, the achievements of Chabad, I stand on Chaim Soloveitchik, who led the Lajna Rebbe, that the Rav was not a messianist, goes without saying. The Rebbe of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, it was not what happened in the late 80s into the 90s. That's a different story, and it hurts me to talk about it, to analyze it. It would seem to me that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was too successful, and the movement became so large and so watered down, and so many people lived only on the Rebbe's look and word and smile, and there wasn't enough basic learning, that ultimately it centered around one man. And it's a shame. But if you ask me, on the other hand, who could have been Mashiach? No one else in the 20th century is equal to Lubavitcher Rebbe. I often think, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe my Zionist feeling is clouding my thinking, had the Rebbe come in Aliyah after the Six-Day War, had the Rebbe come to Kiryat Arba, Chabad, Chevron was always a Chabad town. The Rebbe of Chevron in 1929 slaughtered, was a slunim, slaughtered by the Arab hordes, was an anacle of the Alter Rebbe. Had the Lubavitcher Rebbe come in 1967, I think the whole history of the State of Israel would have been different. And who knows if Mashiach would not be here already. The whole history, the tshuva, what would have happened, the hit Orerot, the Gadlut, the Rebbe, Chevron today, Kiryat Arba today, I can throw myself, chaval, what could have been. Those are the worst thoughts of all, what could have been. Maybe I'm wrong. Those of you that are Chabad Hasidim, forgive me for talking this way. Maybe I'm wrong, but I've often thought about it. I've spoken with Chabad people on a high level, and they get very upset when I talk this way, because you understand the Rebbe had a goal, had to remain in America, there was a purpose, and what was in America could have been 1,000 times more right here, al Admat HaKodesh. The story with Karanatzi and Nacht, it's a magnificent story. Once again, the little kid, his Rebbe, he doesn't understand, and years later, he can give such learned drashot on Melech Asur B'Rahatim. It's a meritic thought. How can a kid understand that? But when you mature, then in retrospect, Habich Vashtanin, I understood what my Rebbe in Cheder told me. The story of Rabbi Menachem Kasdim, of course, conquers today, and few things will ever equal that story. And the postscript of Atara and the postscript of Menachem Kasdin, the tzaddik living in Bayit Vagan, the joy, actual joy I brought to the Almana, to Rebbetzin Atara Tversky, was worth the entire trip to Boston. My dear students, next week in this class we begin the Lithuanian world. Don't come to class unless you're Bucky and all of Shas and Poskim. Unless you're cynical and have a good sarcastic Lithuanian sense of humor. With that background, you will start to understand the Rav. Whatever you do, no sputtik and no strimal. Sunday, we continue with Ethiopian Jewry, finish up the Radbaz. We come into the contemporary, the history of how they were discovered, and we come into the contemporary machloket, which unfortunately could have been such a different story. We lack public relations. That machloket, still, the embers are still there until today. The Sunday afterwards,